Welcome to Greenbelt Festival Recorded Talks. This talk features Billy Bragg speaking at Greenbelt 2007. The topic is, can Britishness be defined in a new Bill of Rights?
A lot of people have suddenly turned up for a chat about Englishness. How weird is that, Britishness? I don't know what's going on, but there does seem to be a bit of a, something of the zeitgeist at the moment about this subject. I don't know why you're interested in it, but the reason I'm interested in it is because the British National Party won 12 seats in my hometown in Barking in East London. Although I'm sorry that the issue, predominantly the issue of immigration, is so far up the political agenda now. I'm sorry that we have to talk about these things, but I do believe we do. Those of us from the traditional left, we've always really eschewed any considerations of national identity because we're internationalists, and I'm an internationalist. But by refusing to talk about issues of national identity, we've created a vacuum, which the that we've left it very easy for the British National Party to fill. We've made it a simple task for them, come in and define who does and who doesn't belong. We've left it to the Daily Mail, to the Tebbitites, to decide who is and who isn't British. And I think if we want to create an inclusive society, then we on the progressive side of politics have got to start to articulate what it is we mean, how we see that society. And so these notions of national identity come to the fore. It's a fact. And one of the strange things about my job is one week I'm talking about this at Greenbelt, another week I'm talking about it at Marxism 2007. But such is my demographic. They really didn't like it at Marxism 2007 when I suggested that for most people, nationality is a more a real identity than class identity. They really didn't like that. But it's a fact and something that over time we've distanced ourselves from. I mean, there's good reasons for this. Those of you with long memories will remember the National Front in the 1970s marching through the streets of Britain with their Union Jacks. It's enough to put anybody off flag waving for life, and myself included. I was one of those people who, whenever I saw the Union Jack or the flag of St. George on the back of a white minivan, I immediately thought the worst at a person who was driving that minivan. And I think this is a real problem. You know, if you see the Welsh flag on the back of a white minivan or the Scottish flag or the Irish flag, you don't immediately think that that person is perhaps a racist or a fascist. We do have a problem in England with that whole sense of identity. And in the last couple of years, that's been changing with the use everybody, instead of just a hardcore football fans, everybody using the flag of St. George, the cricket players using the flag of St. George, and rugby winning the Rugby World Cup. The St. George flag now, you when you see it, you don't necessarily immediately think the worst. You look at the person who's waving that flag and you think about the context. And context is everything with flags, with that kind of symbolism. I was talking to some German people about this at WOMAD a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying the great thing about the World Cup in Germany last year was everybody came with their flags. And the Germans, who obviously have rather more problems with that whole idea of flags and nationalism than we do, stood around for a long time thinking, well, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could wave our flag? And slowly they got the confidence, because when everybody else got their flags out in that context, it was okay for the Germans to wave their flag, because it was about now. Instead of being linked to the past, they were able to wave their flag. And I think that's what happens here. When we get our flag of St. George out, everyone else can get their flags out too. My wife was born in Trinidad and Tobago to British parents. And she's been living in this country since she was 6 years old, but she's always got a very strong Trinidadian identity. And never more so than when we were playing them in the World Cup last year, when she suddenly took an incredible interest in football that had hitherto not been obvious. And when next door put up the flag of St. George, and the other side put up the Union Jack, Juliet said to me, wouldn't it be great to put up the flag of Trinidad and Tobago? And the internet being what it is, it took me like 48 hours to get one. It came in the post. I held it up to her proudly. Ta-da! She said, "What's that?" I said, "It's the flag of Trinidad and Tobago." She said, "Great. Stick it up the flagpole." We don't have a flagpole, I'm afraid. So I took the mop handle and tied that to the balcony in our house and put up this great big flag. It's a lovely flag. It's a red flag with a white line with a black line inside it across. And we flew it. Everybody could in the village could see it flying from our house when England played Trinidad. And they just assumed, everyone in the village just assumed we were Scottish. The iconography of flags is very important, but also the using of flags in a non-pejorative way is also acceptable. People have the right to express their sense of who they are. You know, there are some times where you feel to step forward and say, "Yes, I am English. Here's my flag," or "Yes, I am Christian. Here's my faith." You've wondered the company that you're in. We need to move away from those. The situation, because ultimately identity is personal. It's not national. It's not class-based. It's informed by your nationality. It's informed by your background. You do have a sense of your own class. You do have a sense of your own identity, but your own identity may not be as straightforward as it is on your passport. You may have a parent or a grandparent from another country that you feel a strong affinity to. You may have something in your background that you feel adds something to your identity that you're very, very proud of and is central to your sense of who you are. Identity is personal. It's only when someone gets in your face and tries to define who you are by your religion or by your race or by your accent or by your football team or whatever. Identity is personal. And as a consequence of this, so Britishness is also personal. The things that you feel define our country are things that you see in it that you feel strongly about. It may be positive, they may be negative, but your construct of what is British, what constitutes Britishness or Englishness or Scottishness, Welshness, the things that you feel constitute these ideas is personal. If we had all of us together now tried to construct our own idea of what that is, we would all come up, we would find it'd be very, very difficult to come up with some, you know, a list of things that we could all agree on. I mean, take for instance the first thing, the thing that will be the top of everybody's list of what it means to be British, the defining thing perhaps of Englishness is Marmite. You know, is there ever something that divided people more than Marmite? You know, I'm a Marmite artist. I don't know if you know that. People either love me or they hate me. There's no in between, and I'm proud of that because I'm a savoury guy. I love Marmite. So, but it's just one example. Imagine if being British, you were enforced to eat Marmite. You know, there are many people I think who would be emigrating to somewhere where you're forced to drink Guinness or other thing or something. I don't know, some other place. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. These are broadly abstract ideas, but they're becoming less abstract and more focused. Take for instance, last weekend I was at the Edinburgh Book Festival talking about my book, and this was in the same week that the leader of the Scottish National Party, Alex Salmond, had asked for a referendum on Scottish independence. So let me tell you, they were totally focused on these things I'm talking about. In fact, they were ahead of the curve. They were clear about who they were, and they knew exactly why they were different from the British. They were clear about that in a way that I don't think we English are or have been for a long time. So these debates are moving forward. And there are, you know, there are many different types of patriotism. As many different types as there are of Christianity or of socialism. There are different types of patriotism. Look at the of nationalism. Look at the nationalism of the British National Party compared to the Scottish National Party. You'd think there'd be two parties with a huge similarity. When those men crashed that car into Glasgow Airport last month, the Scottish National Party, the first thing they said was that, you know, wherever you're from, we are all Scottish. And at a time like this, we have to stand together with our Muslim neighbours who are Scottish, just as Scottish as us. The British National Party, after July 7th, 2005, printed a leaflet which they sent round the houses in Barking and Dagenham with a picture of the bus that had been exploded, Tavistock Square, saying, "Now do you believe us?" So there's a completely different approach from two parties. So the idea of patriotism, of nationalism, is not necessarily always a negative force. It can be to do with being proud of your country. Not in the I salute the flag kind of proud. I'm a bit suspicious of Gordon Brown's idea about everyone having a Union Jack in their back garden. I don't think that's the way to make us be British, by enforcing symbols on us, because they are just that, symbols. And again, those symbols have different meanings to different people. But there has to be something that we have that binds us together. I'm a great supporter of multiculturalism. But even I'm aware that there's a gap in the middle of our society where the thing that unifies us and brings us together should be. Now, you may feel that should be faith. And I wouldn't disagree with that. I would feel it should be a collective will, as manifested in the welfare state. But both you and I know that we're living in an increasingly secular and consumerist society. Those ideas of faith that used to bind us together as a people are no longer held by the majority of people. And the ideas of democratic socialism, which founded the welfare state, which our parents and grandparents worked so hard and suffered so long in the Second World War to create, are also being pulled apart by the forces of capitalism. So neither of us can any longer put our hands on those ideas and say this is what defines us. In the end, I think we need a non-political, non-spiritual idea that binds us together, and that's how we come around to the idea of a Bill of Rights, the idea of a series of fundamental rights that belong to all of us, and that have inherent in them not only rights and freedoms, but also responsibilities to one another. Now, presently, we have our rights are guaranteed by the European Union. We have the European Convention of Human Rights, which was the grounds that were talked about last week with regard to the release of the murderer of the headmaster, Mr. Lawrence. And those rights come to us from Europe rather than from our own society, because we don't have a written constitution. We have a constitution. Of course we have a constitution. But it's a constitution that's capable of being I wouldn't like to say abused, but it's a constitution that's capable of being updated and bent out of shape by politicians, because it's the executive, it's the prime minister, it's the government that more or less controls the constitution. In this country, you're free to do anything that the government don't make illegal. Now, you can see how quickly that could change. Instead of having fundamental rights that the government can't mess with, they're in control. And this is an anomaly in modern societies. In most countries, the constitution controls the government. Everybody talks disparagingly about the United States Constitution, what a failure it is. But you have to ask yourself why Guantanamo Bay is in Cuba and not in Alabama. And that's because the American Constitution forbids that kind of treatment to anybody, even prisoners of war, so-called. So the American Constitution does work, it's just that the executive are constantly trying to subvert it. But it does work as an idea. It provides the American people with a set of rules that don't always get obeyed, but at least if you've got the rules in your hand, you know when the government are breaking those rules. You can see that. You might not always be able to stop them, but at least you have the rules. When my son goes to school, they have the school rules up on the wall. He walks past them every day. They never had that when I was a kid. And that doesn't only help everyone to understand the rules, but it also helps my son, if he ends up in the head teacher's office, he knows the parameters. He knows where he stepped over the line. Or he equally knows where he can point to these rules and say, I haven't done that. I've stayed within those parameters. And that's what a written constitution does. It gives us a set of rules by which we can attempt to deal with the difficult problems that we face in a modern society where everyone's rights compete with everybody else's. A written constitution wouldn't solve all our problems. but it would give us a framework with which to deal with some of the difficult problems that we face up to. For instance, the right of a woman to wear the niqab. Now, whether she should wear that in a classroom or not is her business, and that should, rather should be dealt with by the school purely. But what she does outside of there, that is her freedom of expression to wear what she wants to wear. And we should no more be telling her what she wants to wear than we should be telling you what you should wear. But her reciprocal responsibility to us as a society, as she has the right to wear the niqab, which I don't particularly agree with, is she has to accept Salman Rushdie's right to be the author of the satanic verses, to say what he wants to say. Rights have to be reciprocal. Responsibility has to go with rights. Unless they do, these are not rights. These are privileges that you have that you don't have to share with anybody else. So why haven't we got a written constitution? This is a question that people, I heard someone say on the radio, it was because the air in England is purer than anywhere else and we don't need a constitution. I've obviously never been to Barking, the people who said that. We have to do a bit of history now. The reason we don't have a written constitution is because we had our revolution before the ideas of human rights had really been expressed. The French Revolution, the American Revolution, were fortunate in the fact that they had a guy named Tom Paine, who came from Thetford in Norfolk, to write down their ideas in terms of the rights of the individual. In the 17th century, around the time of the English Civil War and the English Revolution, these ideas hadn't yet been developed. In fact, the men and women who fought in the Civil War, they were using the Bible. The Bible was their great inspiration. The levellers, and particularly the diggers, were inspired by the Bible. And Cromwell himself was inspired by the Bible. And the issue that they fought the Civil War on was an issue very dear to the hearts of British people, and that's the issue of fairness. You're probably aware, you've probably read, that British people, when asked to define their fundamental values, often go for fairness and tolerance. These are the things that define us as a people now. Sure, everyone in this room will know that these are merely aspirations rather than realities, but all the same, they're aspirations that are worth following up. Because throughout our history, there is a thread of fairness and tolerance that dates all the way back to Magna Carta, all the way back to Magna Carta, to the barons who thought it wasn't fair that King John could put them in prison without trial and hold them for as long as he liked. So on grounds of fairness, the barons went to King John at Runnymede and made him sign the Magna Carta. Now, this was the first such document in European history, first attempt to hold absolute power to account. This was a defining moment. That idea of not accepting power without accountability was the driving force behind the Reformation, the break with Rome. It came to the fore again in the 1620s with King Charles I, when he tried to rule for 11 years without calling Parliament, because Parliament wouldn't give him what he wanted. They wanted a say in the raising of taxes. They didn't want him to raise taxes without their consent. And that idea about fairness and rule by consent was what the Civil War was fought over. Because when he finally did recall Parliament in 1640, they had a set of ideals that they'd first presented to him in the 1620s, which they made him sign up to, and he still wouldn't sign up to them because he believed in the divine right of kings. And so he went up to York and raised his standard, and the Civil War began. And it wasn't a war for republicanism. It wasn't a war to create a revolutionary society. It was a war to create rule by consent. And when they couldn't get that from Charles I, and they wanted to stop the senseless killing of their fellow Englishmen and women, they captured him and they didn't know what to do with him. What are we going to do with him? He won't accept this idea of consent. So they did something else that had never been done before because they believed in fairness. They put a king on trial for treason. This had never been done before. Before, treason was something you did against the king. After, treason became something you did against the state. And because they believed in fairness, they tried him in an open court, and ultimately they executed him in the name of fairness. And that wasn't their intent. Afterwards, they were left in a difficult position. What are you going to put on the postage stamps? You know, a bloody stump sends a message, but, you know, they had no, you know, they got to this place. They had no doctrine of republicanism. They had no, you know, Karl Marx or Tom Paine to give them to frame their revolutionary idea. They came to this place in search of rule by consent, not in search of revolution, not in search of republican. And ultimately, when it didn't quite work out, they brought back Charles I's son, Charles II, but crucially, on their terms, on Parliament's terms. He signed up to Parliament's terms. And just like the Cromwell Commonwealth, the Restoration didn't work either. James II, Charles I's other son, came in. He was a self-professed Catholic. The Parliament was strongly Protestant. And ultimately, they had to get rid of him. They didn't chop his head off. They just brought in William of Orange to marry Charles II's daughter, Mary. And just to make sure everyone understood what was going on here, they made William and Mary sign something called the Bill of Rights, the 1689 Bill of Rights, which is, you might say, well, we already have a Bill of Rights. We do, but the unfortunate thing with the 1689 Bill of Rights is we ain't in it. It's an agreement between the Crown and Parliament about who has the right to raise taxes and raise an army. The British people are not involved in the 1689 Bill of Rights at all. And were excluded, the people were excluded from any kind of political expression, voting, any of these things until very early, really, in the 20th century. The Reform Acts of the 1830s gave the vote to people who had enough property. They disenfranchised the majority of people on grounds of the men, they didn't own a big enough house, and women just because they were women. And despite the best efforts of the Chartists in the 19th century and of the suffragettes in the first part of the 20th century, it wasn't really until after the First World War. The majority of British soldiers in the First World War didn't have the vote. The vast majority, because they didn't own big enough property. It was only after that war, in 1918, that women over 30 and all men over 21 got the vote. And it wasn't until later on, really, until the 30s, that we had universal suffrage in the way that we think of it now. So it's been a constant struggle to get our rights. It's been a constant push. And those ideas of fairness have always been at the centre of it, not of revolution, but of fairness, of a society in which everybody gets their say, in a society in which the government rule by consent. And I think these ideas are ideas that it will be very, very valuable to be debating again, to be talking about again, these notions. Because this history that we have has got to be the core of our new settlement. It doesn't come out of the blue, this idea that we should have a constitution. People have been fighting for it for years and years and years. And although it relies heavily on history, it's not an exclusive history. It's a history that does have resonance for people who have just arrived in our country. Because as far as I can see, from the barons to the Reformation, the Civil War, the Chartists, the Suffragettes, it's been a constant story of people who are excluded. Excluded by property, excluded by gender, excluded now by religion, particularly for the Muslim, British Muslim population. People who are excluded from taking part in society because of their religion and because of the public perception of them. the story of our history has been one of people excluded, breaking the ring on their own terms, becoming part of the mainstream on their terms, the barons, the Protestant church, the Civil War, Parliament, the Chartists, the suffragettes. That's our tradition as well. That's our history as well. So this does have something to say to those people who have just come to our country. It's not exclusive. It is an inclusive tradition. And it's by reaching into this tradition, I think, that we will best be able to drive forward change. The diggers and the levellers in the 1640s constantly referred back to Magna Carta. In fact, even further back to pre-Norman times. And in order to get anything done in this country, you have to take on board, to go forward, you have to take the traditionalists with you. And I think this case, to make a case from our history, would be a very, very important weapon in this new settlement between ourselves. And oddly enough now, it seems there's a mainstream recognition of the need to do this. I think it's partly because of the recent human rights debate. It's also about whether or not we should get our laws from Europe or whether these rights should be repatriated and be here and be ours. There's a huge debate about Britishness going on. And all these things run together, because if we are going to have something that defines us, then a set of basic fundamental human rights, I think, is the one thing that we can all agree around, whatever our religion, whatever our politics, whatever our class, our gender, our sexuality. Basic fundamental human rights and responsibilities that are available to everyone in our society is something that we can all, the thing that will bind us together in our beautiful diversity. And it's an issue that I think would also help around the notions of immigration. One of the real problems with the whole integrationist argument is that while we expect people who come to our country to integrate, we don't give them anything to aim for. We don't tell them, you know, these are the things that define who we are. We, you know, they do their citizenship exam, they pledge allegiance to the Queen, we shake them by the hand, and then we just leave them to make their own mind up what it means to be British. I mean, they walk out and see, you know, people drunk laying in the streets. I mean, is that what we're asking them to come out and do after Friday prayers? Come and get drunk with us? No, it's not. We have a better idea of what our society is. So a set of principles would give those people who want to integrate something to aim for. But crucially, they would also empower the newcomers to hold us to account by those same rules. To be able to say to us, look, it says here that you are a fair and a tolerant people. Where's the fairness and tolerance in the way that you're treating me? So these issues in a post-ideological society are neither issues of left or right. They're issues of fundamental human rights and how we relate to one another in our society. And I do hope that it's something that you feel is of importance, and it does play heavily into this debate about who we are and how we define ourselves, so that we're not defined by flags or football teams or demographics, that we're actually defined by the freedoms and the responsibilities that we show to one another. You know, when I first started writing and singing about ideas of national identity, I wrote a song called England Half English, and the end of the song, the song's actually based, the tune is from an Arabic song called Song of the Exiles, and the chorus of the Arabic song was translated as, oh my country, what a beautiful country you are. So I thought, I will sing that at the end of this song. I'll just sing that over the fade out. And a dear friend of mine, fellow leftist, said to me, you're being ironic, right? And I said, no, I'm not being ironic. I do love this country for all its failures. I love it like I love my son. You know, I want the best for it, but also I don't want it to, you know, to be spoiled. I want it to understand that it has responsibilities. So I have to chastise occasionally, but ultimately, you know, it's where I live, it's where I've grown up, it's a part of me. But the real reason why this is crucially important, this issue of who we are, is because of the pressure that's being put on the issue by the British National Party, by the racists. because ultimately I don't, you know, I don't mind where you're from, you know, but really this has to be about where we are. It has to be about place rather than race, and where you are now rather than where your grandparents are from, because it's here that we're going to make a society. It's here we're going to make a cohesive society together. You know, I have respect for your faith. I have respect for your ethnic background. But the thing that's most important to me, the thing that trumps everything else, is how are my kids going to get on with your kids? And that's why this issue is very, very important. Thank you very much. We've got the old roving mic. If you'd like to take questions, I'm happy to take questions on any subject. But and I'll try and pick out as many people as I can. I don't know what we can do. A few people up in the balconies, maybe a megaphone. Yeah, there's a woman there in the white there. Chap over there as well.
Okay, we'll start in the middle and then we'll come over here.
Okay.
I was interested in you saying about Britishness. So I'll stay on topic. But you seem to be using it interchangeably with Englishness. And that's something I hear a lot. I'm Welsh. And I'm trying to work out how that fits, because I'd like to see some sort of Britishness as an umbrella, so I can be British and Welsh, along with my British Asian friends and my British Muslim friends. But I think we have to reclaim that word Britishness somehow, so it doesn't mean English. And personally, I think that needs to be, as a positive English nationalism.
No, I completely agree with you, and I apologise. I wasn't using them intermediately. I was just flipping between my different levels of identity there. Using a bit of English history, if you don't mind, to work with the Magna Carta and the Civil War. But yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things about us. We do have that duality. British identity is two-part. You have your British identity, then you have the identity of your birth country, and that may be Wales, it may be England. In my wife's case, it's Trinidad. But the great thing is we do all have that duality, and it's how we come together around the overarching identity, the identity, because, you know, it says on your passport, I assume you're a British citizen. Yeah, well, you can't be a Welsh citizen. You can't get a Welsh passport. I mean, maybe one day. Who knows? But at the moment, you know, Englishness, Welshness, Scottishness are as much a state of mind as anything else. But no, I totally accept what you say about reclaiming. And you know, when you think about it, if you can bear to do it for a moment, you know, what could be more multicultural than a Union Jack? It's the flag of many nations come together. You know, if Britishness is anything, it's always been diverse. It's always by its diversity. And for those of you who are English as well, let's remember we are Anglo-Saxon. That little hyphen, very, very important. That's our ancient diverse tradition. The golden hyphen of King Alfred. It's in the British Museum. You might see it sometime. But that hyphenated identity is very, very important to me as an English person. So who's next? Yep. Are you picking these out or am I picking them out? You know them.
Yeah, I know them all, yeah. Okay, let's go to the lady over here.
I was involved, as I guess many people were, in the anti-poll tax campaign, which had a big philosophy, a big issue that this was wrong behind it. Since then, I've been involved in the anti-destitution campaign around asylum seekers. And I'm struck that, 20 years on now, there doesn't seem to be that same big groundswell. And I'm just thinking, the philosophy that established the welfare state, the philosophy that did that, we seem to have got lost in budgets. And I know there's an issue with we can't feed, house everyone. But that grand vision, when we think about destitution, seems to have gone. I mean, when we collect food at festivals, people say to us, it doesn't seem a very British thing that people are left to starve, to be homeless. But I'm just wondering, are we losing our visions in the midst of counting the pennies? And I didn't know what you think, so.
Well, yeah. I think that we, for better or for worse, we live in a post-ideological society compared to the 1980s when there was a strong, you know, people strongly divided themselves ideologically, and the miners' strike, for instance, it divided everybody. You know, there are issues such as the Iraq and Afghanistan war where there's a great groundswell of public opinion. I mean, more people marched against the war in 2003 than ever marched with us in the 1980s. So I totally oppose the idea that people aren't interested in politics. It's just that the idea of a constitution is not so easily articulated as issues of the poll tax. They don't seem to be so close to home. But it's those issues of your human rights and where they come from and whether they can be taken away like that. And increasingly in the war on terror, so-called, we're finding that our liberties are being chipped away at. And I think if it happens, it's going to be a very strange confluence of people who can't stand speed cameras and people like me who are roundheads at heart. So you find some strange bedfellows. I was sitting down talking to Simon Heffer about this the other day. How strange is that? He wanted to talk to me. He's appalled by ID cards because they'll be used to stop black youth. He says it's a ridiculous thing. State shouldn't do that. So we're going to have to think a bit out of the box in the way that we used to think in the old days of the poll tax to get these ideas. But I do think that there's much more interest in these kind of constitutional issues now than perhaps when Charter 88 was founded back in the 1980s, strangely enough. Yes.
Hey, we're over. You're going. Let's call it, yeah.
Billy, thanks for writing your book and bringing all this stuff to us. I think it's really great, and we appreciate it a great deal, the way you're keeping these issues live. Quite a practical question, really. A Bill of Rights, is it a 200-page document? Is it a 500-page document? Or is it an A4 mission statement? And, you know, I just would despair as soon as it went over about one or two pages, because... What the hell, you know, it just would go on and on, wouldn't it? It would cover every...
It's a PDF, mate.
Yeah, but it's a 10 meg PDF, isn't it?
It's a PDF that doesn't go to more than 6 pages. The first page, A4 page, will hold freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, those big ones. There'll be 3 pages to do, and this is in common with all constitutions, there'll be 3 pages that are solely to do with people in custody and the rights of people to jury trial and those kind of issues. Because what constitutions, you know, most of us don't really worry about what's in the constitution. We don't bother it. If you get arrested, the constitution becomes very, very important because it governs what happens to you where you are when you're in custody. So all constitutions involve a lot. I think it would be quite similar to the European Convention, except it will guarantee jury trial. Jury trial, the right to jury trial, is not in the European Convention, but it would be similar to that. But the most important thing it would be, unlike the European Convention, it wouldn't be bolted on without a debate. We need a constitutional convention where we can come together and argue out these ideas and you know, have a understand, because we need to understand that there are responsibilities there. It's not just all about my human rights. It's also about your responsibility to uphold everybody else's human rights. And you only really find those things out through debate. You can't just dig it through people's letterbox or email it. So I would hope it would be not more than about 6 pages. Okay. You can print it on a T-shirt. In fact, this is just as an idea. The idea of ID cards, whilst I understand where Simon F. is coming from, it may be that it's necessary to have such a thing in order to ensure that none of us get blown up on the tube. I don't want to get blown up on the tube, and I don't want any of you to be blown up on the tube either. So I'm willing to have an ID card, providing it has a Bill of Rights printed on the back. So that's how big it will be. Big enough to be printed on the back of an ID card. How about that?
So these ID cards are going to be massive.
So yeah, someone did say to me after I said that, well, would you fold it out? I'm like, no, it's a metaphor!
A metaphor.
I'm a songwriter!
So, yeah, in the middle of where the mic is, and then way over in that corner, please.
Sorry, yeah.
On the subject of the Bill of Rights...
Can you stand up? Oh, yeah.
So on the subject of a Bill of Rights, the strength of the European Convention, which of course has been incorporated in the Human Rights Act, is that it gives quite a succinct but very strong set of values with which the judiciary can review any law which the government makes. And that, what's, I think, quite encouraging about this, it's been used particularly by outsiders, by foreigners, to challenge actions which the government's proposed to take against them. And it seems the weakness in a Bill of Rights, particularly one that's only 6 pages, is that it can only cover certain situations. So I just wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more on why a Bill of Rights would in fact be better, be stronger, improve on the Human Rights Act.
But a very simple reason that it wouldn't be able to be abandoned. Politicians won't be able to stand up and say, we're going to abrogate from it, we're going to ignore that, it's European, nothing to do with us. I mean, the fact that British lawyers helped write it you know, doesn't seem to make any sense to those. I want something entrenched in our law, which has never been done before. I mean, we're in kind of like a legal Pandora's box, perhaps, here, but something that's entrenched that can't be changed except by a majority through a referendum, that kind of thing, or amended. Those kind of ideas, I think, would be much more useful than something that, for most people, is part of their negative perception of the you know, Brussels laws from Brussels and Strasbourg. I mean, the Human Rights Act doesn't properly incorporate it. It just means that we can get it in British courts. It doesn't give us any more rights. I'd like something that's fashioned for ourselves that begins with a debate and ends with a consensus.
Okay, we've got another mic over there. Yep.
Okay. Arguably, the most disastrous right in the American Constitution is the right of the individual to bear arms. And we don't currently have a National Rifle Association here. And so if we were to draw up a Bill of Rights now, it probably wouldn't include that. But it's not inconceivable that sometime in the future, if the rising wave of hysteria over gun crime kind of brings that issue forward, who gets to decide what's in this, and how do we stop something like the right to bear arms ending up in it?
Well, I thought it was the right to arm bears. I must be reading that. See, that sounds the wrong way around to me. Yeah. Unfortunately, the Americans wrote their constitution in the 1770s. So it does reflect that kind of society, and a constitution that we wrote would necessarily reflect our society. But the thing that's people are going to be complaining about in our Bill of Rights in 200 years' time, it's not the right to bear arms. It's going to be the right to guaranteed healthcare, the right to decent, affordable housing, the right to a free education. They're the things that we're going to put in that people in the future are going to have a problem with. And I think those things should be set into some kind of stone and passed down the generations, because that gives us something then to defend. I think the right to bear arms is an anomaly, really, that the Americans should have dealt with a long time ago. And I think the majority of Americans who aren't members of the NRA would really like to do something about that.
Lady in pink, over on the back there.
Hi. I'd like to suggest that any debate we start starts with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we all signed up to in 1948. Whilst it's not a law, it's what we all aspire to, and which, for instance, Amnesty International holds countries to account for. And within that, I think we find the framework of everything we need. We might want to specify more things like jury as opposed to the right to a fair trial. But, you know, the aspirations of Universal Declaration need to be more known, I think, because they're for everybody in the whole world. And if we want to be inclusive, that's the one that we need to hold up.
I mean, I would agree with you, greatly agree with that. The Universal Declaration is very, very important. But the problem we have with our xenophobic media and right-wing press is a resistance to anything that's perceived to be foreign. Never mind that a lot of the ideas in the Universal Declaration and in the American Constitution come ultimately from Magna Carta. What we need to do is to thread back to Magna Carta and draw that thread through the Universal Declaration, through the European Convention, through those aspects of the American Constitution about holding the executive to account. These ideas about accountability, we need to draw them into our new modern constitution, workable constitution, because I think this is going to be one of the important ideas of the 21st century, accountability. How do you hold those in power to account? And over the years, we've kind of got away without worrying about those kind of things. But now, without a written constitution, without a set of formal principles and rules, we're finding that in the name of national security, our government are able to cut, severely cut into our individual liberties. More and more people are becoming aware of this. So I think rather than going back to the UN Declaration and going out to the European Convention, it's forging something ourselves that is inspired by the rights in the European Convention, that marries up to those rights and to the European Convention rights, but that we can say is fundamentally ours. You can't abolish this. You can't take these rights away from it. We've had these rights since Magna Carta, and they belong to us as a society.
Can you see Gordon Brown putting this in his manifesto?
I can see that they are talking about these kind of issues. I think they do realise. I mean, you know, the more David Cameron says, I'm going to abolish the Human Rights Act, the more likely it is. I just wish it was not so negative. I just wish we were coming at it from a more positive angle, because obviously, you know, the rights of the individual are extended to those people who are in state custody. Prisoners have rights. In fact, you can define a society by how it treats its prisoners. And although it's awful, must be awful for the Lawrence family to see the possibility of this man being released on the streets of Britain. I know if it had been my father or my partner who had been killed, I'd find it very, very difficult to live with. We have a system whereby people are tried and punished for their crimes. And when that young man does finally get probation, whether it's after 12 years or longer, when he does get probation, he will have paid for his crime. What he does after then is his own business.
At the back there?
Yeah, I warm to that idea of kind of a Bill of Rights or a constitution holding politicians accountable. One of the other concerns I have is that I think in our country we've made such a big thing of freedom of the press. I shudder at the thought of politicians controlling the press, but the freedom of the press things allows the Daily Mail to write the trash it writes so often. Would you consider a Bill of Rights holding the press accountable as well as the government?
Well, I think we do need to hold the press to account somehow. The idea of their self-regulation, I don't think, is working. But by the same token, freedom of expression is a crucial part of our ideas and the way freedom of thought have developed. And unfortunately, that includes the sort of stuff that we see in our daily newspapers. So it'd be hard to have a constitution that control. I think the constitution wouldn't be able to control that kind of thing, but it may well be able to set a framework for a debate about the responsibilities that the media has to society, not to scaremonger, not to encourage splitting society apart by printing negative stories. I was saying last night on stage, I've come to realise over the years that what I'm fighting against is not capitalism or conservatism, it's cynicism. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that about, both in our media and in our politics. This bloke, he's been putting his hand up, he's getting more and more. If you don't let him have a mic, he'll chase me home.
Okay.
Down the M5, asking me subsidiaries. Subsidiaries, Billy, subsidiaries. They're a bit quiet in the balcony as well, aren't they, I've noticed. I'm going to throw a mic up there. Go on, mate. Not yeah. him. Go on, mate. Go on.
Okay. The present constitution, dating from a much more intolerant period than ours, states that a Catholic cannot marry into the royal family, become the sovereign, become Lord Chancellor, or hold certain other offices. Gordon Brown says he's no intention of removing that clause. David Cameron certainly wouldn't. How can we be a fully democratic country when one religious group is discriminated against in that way?
Well, I'm all for not discriminating against the royal family. And, I think it's a ridiculous law from a totally different time. It should have been abolished a long time ago. And that's part of our problem. You know, we do rely on that settlement in 1689, which was predominantly a Protestant settlement. It's all about maintaining the Protestant religion in this country. And obviously, now they're having trouble maintaining religion, never mind a Protestant religion, any religion in this country. So, no, I wouldn't agree with that at all. Quick, let him have the mic.
This isn't cynicism, it's practicality and reality.
Yep.
How do we get a Bill of Rights through our elected parliament when our elected members are the ones who have tried on several occasions to deprive us of our rights, and our unelected ones are the ones who have defended them?
Well, yeah, that's a problem. This really is a problem. And I think that what you'll find is that if David Cameron does carry on banging away at the Human Rights Act, then we will have a debate. I mean, whether we like it or not, there is a huge groundswell of libertarians out there who really don't like speed cameras and ID cards and all that kind of stuff. And in some ways, we're going to have to be working with the grain with them a little bit in order to make these things go. And these are, strangely enough, these are sort of traditional Tory notions of individual freedom. And we just need to get that debate more focused around those ideas in the parliament. I think there is the cynicism out there. There is anti-politician cynicism out there. And they've got to do a lot of stuff to build our trust in them again, or people are just going to, you know, voting figures are plummeting. And we need to do a lot to clean the stables. And I think this would be an issue of trust, in which the executive and parliament give power away to the people, in the same way that Brown gave away power to the Bank of England and therefore got trust with the economy. The politicians, in order for people to trust them again, will need to be seen to be giving power away in our direction. I think this is an issue that we may be able to press them on.
As we aspire to fairness and tolerance, there is no mic up there, but does anybody want to shout out a short question? Is that?
Yeah, exactly, mate.
Yeah, somebody in blue. Is that a fair question?
Yes, it is a very fair question. And I hopefully I'll come up with a tolerant answer. I think toleration is about accepting things that you don't agree with, that you don't necessarily agree with, Muslim women wearing the niqab, but I accept their right to do that. In some ways, I tolerate that, although I disagree with it. And it's also respect as well. With regard to the idea of fairness, it is a hard question to say that we as a people are a fair people and we believed in fairness. And if you look into our history, it's not always easy to find examples of that. But I do want to just finish off by dwelling on one single example of why I believe the British people can manifest ideals of fairness and tolerance. There's a reason why most of us in this room had a free education, had free healthcare, had, when we were young, access to decent, affordable housing. That's because in 1948, the Labour Party founded a welfare state. That welfare state was founded on the back of a landslide election victory in 1945, when the majority of the British people, given a choice really between going back to what was going on before the war, which was perceived as an unfair society in which the poor were heavily marginalised, or building a new Jerusalem, a fairer society based on fairness. They learned that through the terrible, terrible experience of the Second World War, where they made huge sacrifices both abroad and at home. They realised that the only way you can resolve these problems that we face is by working together, by collective action. So in 1945, the British people voted in overwhelming numbers, having come through the awful cataclysm of the war, voted in favour of a fair society and made that commitment. And we owe it to them, our generation and the generations that follow, we owe it to them to keep faith with that idea, because they learned that great, great personal expense. And we owe it to them to remain connected with that idea that the individual, the rights of the individual are sacrosanct, but they can only be guaranteed through the provision of free healthcare, free education, decent, affordable housing. The idea that the individual doesn't stand alone, that it's collective provision that allows us, gives us the opportunity to reach our full potential. This idea of the creation of a fair society is the key moment in British history, in our post-war history. And again, we were there before everybody else, just like with Magna Carta, just like with chopping the king's head off. So that's why I say that we do have this tradition here. It's not something that just happened at Runnymede in 1215 or chopping off the king's head in 1649. This is something my parents and your grandparents, some of you, actually created for us that we still benefit from. That's who we are. We're those people who believe in each other. We're those people who have faith in the ability of all of us together as a community to be able to make a society in which we can stand together as equal and all of us reach our full potential. That's what being British means. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Billy Bragg, the troubadour of the New Jerusalem.
Thanks for listening to Greenbelt Festival Recorded Talks.